Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is April the 13th, 2022, and this is a very special and I anticipate a very interesting podcast today. It is a continuation of a discussion of the principles of taxation generally and the Fair Tax Initiative specifically. Listeners may recall my earlier podcast with Jim Bennett, so this, I think, should be thought of as Fair Tax Podcast number two. And I'd like to actually begin this. We're in the context the last few weeks of the Biden Green Book. And, you know, I mean, only in the United States is, our proposed tax changes, you know, on the front page of papers and, you know, and so topical, which tells you something about the role of taxation in the United States, but Western democracies. But this really, you know, I mean, I think this is completely out of control. And I'm reminded of some wisdom from the late President Ronald Reagan in his 1981 inaugural speech, where he begins with, "So as we begin, let us take inventory. We are a nation that has a government, not the other way around. And this makes us special among the nations of the earth. Our government has no power except that granted to it by the people. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed." Well, my personal view of this is that the Internal Revenue Code has replaced the Constitution as the de facto Constitution of the United States. And with that perhaps provocative thought, I'd like to invite Jim and Steve to introduce themselves and the Fair Tax Initiative. Perhaps start with Jim.
Oh, good morning, John, and thank you for having me on your podcast. And I'm Jim Bennett. I've been involved with the Fair Tax Organization since 2005. I'm now a member of the board, I'm the secretary, and I'm the grassroots director of the movement. And I got started when I was driving up the New Jersey Turnpike and heard this fellow named Neil Bortz, who's not in our market, talk about this thing called the Fair Tax. It's a consumption tax that replaces the Internal Revenue Code, and decided I have to look into it and get involved. So to my wife's chagrin, that's what I've been doing ever since.
Okay, and Steve?
And we're very grateful that he was able to continue doing this in spite of perhaps his wife's chagrin. Jim's an incredibly valuable guy. I am actually the chairman and president of Americans for Fair Taxation, who sponsors the Fair Tax. And we are a 501c4 group, nonprofit, but advocating legislation. And I've been involved in trying to draw attention and get the tax system changed since 1990. And our initial organization was Citizens for an Alternative Tax System, and that merged in 2000 with Americans for Fair Taxation. And we've been working on it. We're basically nonprofit people. I introduce myself a lot of times as a recovering tax attorney because in the 70s and 80s, I was quite enthusiastic at doing things to take advantage of tax benefits for my clients and decided that I was part of the problem, not fixing the problem. So I switched to doing more business law. But I agree with you, the tax system has become the income tax, and actually income tax and payroll system, has become a dog waving the tail of the American people as opposed to the tail in terms of just collecting revenue. So I agree with that, John.
All right, and before we continue, we also have with us Joe Howard, who I think I can describe as a U.S. citizen who actually lives outside the United States. And this is important because the U.S. tax system affects U.S. citizens outside the United States. Joe, would you like to take a second to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Joe Howard. I'm an American living abroad, advocating for Americans abroad against the extraterritorial taxation system. I've been involved in this since about 2017, while living in the United States. And I like to brainstorm ways to try to help Americans abroad and be as free as other foreigners living abroad.
Well, you know, I've got to say to the U.S. residents listening to this podcast, if you think you've got problems, you ought to see how punitively the tax code actually applies to U.S. citizens living outside the United States. All right. You know, it seems to me that a good starting point for this might be, I mean, everybody agrees that, you know, they've had taxes since the beginning of time, and everybody agrees that tax systems are about raising revenue, all right, for sure. But one might ask, should they be beyond that, or should they be restricted to raising revenue? Who would like to kind of lead with that? I mean, we're not going to get rid of taxation anytime soon, I don't think.
Well, I'll start off, and then, you know, Jim did a great job on your podcast of actually introducing this whole topic. But what I would say is that there is a principle that governments that have lasted for a long time, like the government in Rome, followed. And that was, you design a system that raises the necessary revenue, but that does the least damage to the economy and the least damage to your relationship with the citizens. In other words, you make it as easy as you can to raise the money, to comply with your obligations as a citizen, and then you tend to have things very simple on the tax front. Not to say that you can't have a revolution, because this was happening in France, and this was behind Karl Marx's, you know, expose on the Communist Manifesto, remarking on what was happening in Germany in the 1840s. There were lots of people that were evading their responsibility to pay, and the tax was primarily falling on lower income groups. And these were the ones that led revolts and upsets and all. And that's why a lot of the French aristocrats, one of the major reasons, got beheaded. So you want to have a system that is most effective. And I think throughout history, you know, you've seen a lot of countries use import-export taxes. The U.S. primarily funded its government for 100 years on import-export taxes, sale of land, and on excise taxes such as the whiskey tax, which prompted a rebellion back in the 1790s. But basically what you've got is a system that went into effect in 1913, where the leaders felt like they could correct a harm, which was that they believed that wealthy people were not paying their fair share of the tax. And that's been a word used literally for centuries, but in the United States, primarily since the 1890s. And that's when the income tax came about. It started off as a very simple low rate tax. 3 years later, it was 70%, you know, with brackets. So you've got a system that, and Reagan talked about this, a bureaucrat has never met a tax he or she didn't like. They've never felt they had enough money to do what they felt was necessary. And so we should not be surprised that the income tax has continued to morph, not only into something that is invasive and takes our income, but also into something that the bureaucrats and the elites and the people in Congress have started to use, because it's a way of affecting changes they want without actually having to pass legislation that would be enforced in another way. And so that's where you have the income tax child credit. That's where you have all of these other credits and dispensations all being taken into account. And the IRS is using, literally, if you talk to their IT people and read some of the testimony, a lot of their systems from the 1960s, 1970s, from computer systems. They had an incredible problem filling their ranks, and they finally had a job fair and took anybody that walked in the door to help the incredible backlog that's been created. And that's why you see them doing things like trying to administer the childcare credit and not auditing people who make large amounts of money because they don't have time to do both. And then the final thing I'll say on this, having practiced in this area in the past, is when I started working with the IRS, it was very typical to have the auditor who came in to your client be someone who had, you know, who was a I had CPAs, I had people who had master's in accounting, I had people that had bachelor's in accounting, but a lot of training. They're really qualified people. And the conversation you would have wasn't about necessarily the nuances of the code, but you know, you all both knew where you were coming from. And because of the vagueness that's built into the Internal Revenue Code, you disagree. But it was, you know, logical. Today, you've got people who've taken 16 hours of accounting training. They got a degree in some kind of visual arts or something, and they're out doing audits. And of course, they're overwhelmed by a tax practitioner who gets paid a lot of money to study the code. So you have a system that is essentially breaking down. You see that in the skyrocketing rates of evasion in the states. John and Joe, you know, we're over $1 trillion by IRS admission, which tells you it's probably much worse. And in fact, the studies show that it's growing rapidly all the time. So it's a broken system. It punishes the U.S. citizens, and it needs to be replaced. And that's why we want to do a national retail sales tax.
So, you know, that's really fascinating to hear. But one thing that sort of comes through is that, you know, when you get something as complex as this, basically compliance and understanding becomes harder and harder. And I think for a lot of people it's reached the point of impossibility.
Yes.
Would you agree with that?
No, of course. And the, you know, and it's the, all of these things come into, in many cases, judgment calls, particularly with in business audits. You know, was that lunch that John and Joe and Jim and Steve had really a business lunch? Well, the regulations say you have to talk about business, but they don't say how much of the lunch was about business, okay? So you and I, we could have all talked about our grandkids, and Jim in my case, and we could have said, you know, great things about that. And oh, by the way, you know, we're happy to have new clients. Is that a business lunch? Well, nobody knows. And what you have are these untrained, unsophisticated, poor agents. And I say that because they're being thrown into the breach, so to speak, untrained and unable to really grasp everything, coming in and making an arbitrary decision and saying, John, Joe, Jim, that's not a business lunch. And you say, wait a minute, why? And they say, well, that's my story, you know, like the old cowboy, that's my story and I'm not changing. And now you're forced to go to appeal, and you can only hope that their supervisor is someone a little more sophisticated. But all the time, and I know Jim confronts this as well, I get people calling me up and say, I got a computer notice saying I owed $800 in tax. And I said, what's it based on? Well, they're claiming I didn't report this income, but I did. And I said, okay, you know, you have two choices. You can write them a letter and dispute it. But in my experience, that goes into the ether. You're writing a computer, it'll be a year before it's looked at. What's the other option? Pay the tax and move on with your life. And that's what almost everybody does. And so when you look at a system like that, and you see that what they want to do is increase computerization to where they can do more computer assessment, and frankly, their dream is to be able to calculate, all of us on the phone, calculate how much tax we owe and send us a bill. That's the dream. And then it's that old thing, and I think Reagan said this, you know, how much are you making? Well, give it to me and I'll give you back what I decide you need. Because that's really the only way that you're going to collect the income tax in today's world. And that's why it's out of control. What we need to do is replace it. And I think the only logical replacement, and Jim went over a lot of the economic reasons for this, but the only logical replacement is a tax that's easily collected, retail sales tax on new goods and services. Yeah, well, 25 really, states and the District of Columbia have one.
And understood, right? I mean, people understand a sales tax. It's very simple. You know, you're paying a tax, but nobody understands this other stuff. I mean, part of the reason I think why, I mean, I agree that a lot of people will just pay an assessment up to a certain amount because they don't want to get involved in it, right? But even where the numbers are high, there's where do I even begin to understand what the basis of this is and how much will it cost me, you know, to have a conversation with somebody like Steve Hayes or whoever, right? You know, to figure this type of thing out, you know, plus the, you know, just the sheer emotional cost of this thing, which is, which is so extreme. All right. So the other thing that strikes me about the fear tax is it gets the government out of the business of using the tax system for social engineering, right?
Well, mostly. Let me qualify that a little bit. One of the themes that you have with the fair tax is you have a system that does something that the income tax doesn't do. And it says on a simple receipt, John and Joe are going to understand how much they're contributing to the cost of government. It's going to be clear. In our case, 23%. There's no question about it. Now, I defy anybody listening to you or even on this call to tell me how much of the tax that they pay to the federal government of the US, how much of that's going to defense? How much of that's going to social programs? There's no way, because it's all hidden and mismatched around. With the simple fair tax, it's all evident. Now that's frightening to politicians, because suddenly you're going to have people saying, wait a minute, why is it 23%? Well, that's how much it would cost to replace the revenue that we used to receive from the income payroll tax. Everybody's going to see it. Now, if they make a change, they're going to have to show it to all of us. The difference, though, can be, and this is where I qualify a little bit, John, the social engineering, I think it's still much better, but they can do something like say, okay, Joe, you're a guy that never spends less than 150 grand for a car. On cars of 150 grand or more, we're not going to charge 23%. We're going to charge 30%. Okay. The other thing is, because we have a prebate, which effectively is a tax credit, which allows the individuals and families to not pay the fair tax based on what the government's determined is the poverty level. Family of four, it's about $34,000 now. So you can make those purchases and it be out of pocket $0 for federal taxes. However, the way you do that is we'll give you each month at the beginning of the month, I say we, the Social Security Administration, will administer it, will give a check into your bank account, onto your credit card, your debit card. And then you go out and you still pay the tax. So you still feel the pain of paying that 23% tax, but you've been reimbursed before for the tax. So your actual outlay is zero for the tax. Does that make sense?
It does. That's very interesting. So let me you know, let me sort of put this in my own words. So what you're saying is that the fair tax basically replaces all the bureaucracy of tax collection.
Right.
And it's, so it's a one kind of tax, but leaves intact the ability to provide relief where any taxation is a hardship. Have I got that?
That's right. That's right. And it's even, I think Jim made this point in one of his articles. And I think it's a really good point that if you wanted to give some relief to families, rather than have the IRS come up with a check or do all that, you can simply increase the prebate payment for 3 months. So let's say in a COVID or a disaster situation, you wanted to increase relief by $3,000 to every family. You increase the prebate by $250 a month.
So you've already got the mechanism in place.
You've got a mechanism. It's simple. And if you want to cut it off, you cut it off.
Yeah,
they've already filed based on their Social Security return or filing how many people are in their family. So you simply take that data that's in the, and the security has better computers. You take that data and you say, okay, a family of four gets 250 a month. A family of six gets 300 a month. I mean, I don't know, whatever the number is. And it can be, the faucet can be turned on. It runs for however many months you want. Then you turn it off. But it's simple. You don't have to go through all of this complicated thing, and there's not an issue of
whether you hire another few thousand people to administer COVID checks.
Right, right. Yeah. It's simple.
Very, very interesting. Now, so I am right in saying we can all agree, though, that this consumption-based tax applies only to economic activity in the United States.
That's correct.
Which
correct.
Means, Joe, would this solve the problem for Americans abroad?
Yeah, it would, because they wouldn't have to worry about filing or doing anything involving taxes with the U.S. because they live abroad. And national sales tax, it would just be national. So just, it's not international.
You come to the United States, you pay tax, you don't. I mean, you know, isn't that sort of the ultimate form of a physical presence or residency? It also means that that the U.S. ceases to impose tax on extraterritorial income and transactions and things like that.
It would put American citizens on the same tax footing with citizens everywhere else in the world, except Eritrea.
Well, that's right. I'm not sure Eritrea is a great model for the United States or any other country, but that, I mean, that's another interesting, you know, byproduct of this. And of course, you know, gets out a lot of this complexity. Well, Jim, so, I mean, you can probably tell from my tone that, I mean, I'm really excited about this. I think this is great. Okay, so what's there not to like? I mean, why wouldn't people be all over this? I mean, everybody, especially the IRS.
I think when you talk to individuals and get them to understand it, well, we have a saying in our fair tax group, once you understand it, you'll demand it. The problem is getting the word out, and that's why we're so thankful for you, John, and people like you for helping us to spread the word about the fair tax, because otherwise people don't understand it, and the people who are against it are lobbyists. Now, when the fair tax movement first got started, one of our founders, his name was Leo Lindbeck. He was a member of the board of several Fortune 100 companies, and he thought that chief executives of these companies would be jumping all over it. But he found that that just wasn't the case. They have their tax departments, they have their lobbyists who give them a special perch within the current system, and they like things just the way they are. So that's when Leo made the tactical decision to say goodbye to his lobbyists, because they were costing him a lot of money, and instead trying to make this into a grassroots movement, and that's been our focus ever since. So we think that once you can get the word out, get most people to understand it. And this was test marketed, by the way, when it first got started, and it was found to gain great acceptance in markets where it was tested.
Isn't part of the issue, if I can put it this way, that there's always winners and losers and change, always. And if you've got multinationals that are paying lower rates of tax than 23% some way or another, then I suppose it would be natural, or anybody else for that matter, right? I suppose it would be natural for them to oppose this. But I do agree that, you know, part of this is this resistance to change. But do you think at some point, you know, to borrow a possible thought from tax historian Charles Adams, that, you know, if there is no change in the U.S. tax system, there will no longer be a United States? It's gotten so problematic.
I think you're right, John, because our tax system has made us one of the most uncompetitive nations in the world. And we could flip that overnight by adopting the fair tax, because we would go from being, we're probably number one or number two. I think we're going back up to number one in terms of corporate income tax. Japan was ahead of us, and I think they recently reduced their corporate income tax rate. So that makes our goods uncompetitive, because we don't have a VAT that we abate when goods and services leave our shores. So, if we were to go from the current tax system to the fair tax, we would be competitive with Hong Kong, Singapore, the Cayman Islands, the Cook Islands, and capital would come flowing on into the United States instead of going the other way. And I think one of the prime examples is one that you may be familiar with because you live in Canada. You have a chain of fast food stores called Tim Hortons. Tim Hortons used to be a subsidiary of Burger King, but now it's the other way around. Burger King entered into what they call an inversion, and because Burger King got tired of paying tax on its worldwide income, or at least reporting its worldwide income and paying tax on the difference or whatever the system is, so it decided that it was going to become a subsidiary of Tim Hortons, and Tim Hortons was going to be the parent company worldwide. So Tim Hortons didn't have to worry about reporting its worldwide income to Canada. And that made Burger King much more competitive, because now Burger King pays corporate income tax on its domestic receipts, just like any other foreign company doing business in the United States. And it doesn't have to worry about its international receipts. So that, I think you've highlighted some things that are making the United States extremely uncompetitive, and highlighting why the fair tax would be the solution.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the United States may be the most uncompetitive tax system in the world, actually. Partly, I mean, I think it's bad in and of itself, but, you know, there's what I would call a complexity tax, you know, which is sort of added to this, which is unbelievable. I mean, I don't know how anybody can have anything to do with the United States anymore without, you know, getting, you know, tax advice that's necessarily expensive, because these are the most complicated areas of the, you know, of the tax law as it stands.
Yeah, I think complexity is one of the four prongs of a system that best serves its country and its people. And going back to your original point that a tax system should be about raising revenue, period, end of sentence. A tax system that best serves its people would be, first of all, transparent. So people should be able to know whether they're complying with the tax code by reading the four pages of the statute. That's not the case here. It not efficient. An efficient tax raises the maximum amount of revenue for its government with the minimum amount of tax compliance costs. And we know that that's not the case with the current income tax. A good tax should not be drag or a dead weight to economic growth, which our tax code currently is. And a tax code needs to be fair. Now, people on both sides of the aisle can differ as to what makes a tax system fair, but Democrats and Republicans in our country agree that the current tax code is not fair. And let me throw in a couple of bonus points. tax code should be unintrusive. And in addition to that, it should be non-discriminatory. In other words, it shouldn't be picking winners and losers. Now, let's take those 4 points and see if how the fair tax matches up against them. First, the fair tax is transparent. It's 135 pages, double-spaced, wide margins, so people can look at the fair tax statute and pretty much understand whether or not they're in compliance. It's simple. It's efficient because tax compliance rises under the fair tax for a number of reasons. It's not a dead weight to economic growth because it taxes consumption, and it doesn't tax labor, and it doesn't tax capital. And the fair tax is fair, particularly because of the prebate, for a couple of other reasons. It's unintrusive, and it's a non-discriminatory. Everybody pays it. Nobody escapes very few people escape the net. It's very difficult to comply. So we think that if we were to have the fair tax, we would have something that meets all four prongs of a tax system that should be in place.
Well, I think it's certainly a long way, and it's what's interesting to me is that, you know, we start with, you know, 23% tax on consumption or what have you, and then we talk about, well, you know, so there are some people for whom that's such a burden that, you know, there should be relief in terms of a credit or a refund. But what strikes me about it is that if you want the credit or refund, you apply for it, right? I mean, you know, it's sort of a reversal of giving information to the government. You know, if you don't want to give them the information, you just don't apply for the thing, right?
Right.
And exactly. The only thing the government knows is how many people are in your household and whether they're lawfully resident in the United States. So that means either U.S. citizens or non-citizens who have gone through the process of
some kind applying of immigration,
for legal immigration.
Yeah.
And it's very simple. And that's the only thing that the household has to disclose. Mm-hmm. So we have, and I think, but other than that, in terms of fairness, if you look at things other than the prebate that Steve was talking about, a couple of other things go away with the fair tax. First of all, the payroll tax, which funds our Medicare and our Social Security, that's probably the most regressive tax in the federal tax inventory, and that goes away. The programs don't go away, but the tax goes away. Mm-hmm. And then if there's any elasticity of demand and any kind of modicum of supply, we think that the pre-tax prices of goods and services is going to fall because businesses no longer have tax compliance costs, which can be very draconian.
Astronomical.
My dentist once told me that he pays more money in tax compliance costs than accountants than he pays in tax. So those two things go away with the fair tax.
Well, I think that is extremely important. I mean, you know, somebody who sees this, you know, from the perspective of probably the most abusive treatment, you know, meaning individual Americans abroad, where I can think of just, you know, bureaucratic form after bureaucratic, you know, I mean, there's just no end to this stuff. I mean, that would be a huge, huge benefit to citizens, to the country, but I think even more significantly to the IRS. I mean, you know, I have come to see the IRS as actually, as bad as this is probably the single biggest victim of all of this, you know, complexity and, you know, all these number of tax. You know, what you're describing, and I'd be interested in your views on this. I mean, theoretically, what you're describing is a revenue system that could be run out of an office in U.S. Treasury, you know, just by identifying, you know, who's a merchant and selling things, right? And that's basically it, isn't it?
Well, you know, it actually wouldn't even be that complicated. It would be the states doing the collection.
And then just remitting it over.
Yeah.
And merchants who do the merchants who collected on behalf of the states get 25 basis points for their trouble. And the states get 25 basis points for their trouble in remitting and timely remitting to the Federal Tax Bureau, which could probably be in the basement of the current IRS building.
Yeah. And of course, it encourages states to adopt a system that's similar to the federal government as well, right? You know, as a lot of them already do. So, I mean, this sounds, you know, a very, very good idea on so many counts. I mean, of course, there will be people who not like it, but that's just because their individual interests would not be served. I mean, if you see this issue, which I think I would encourage people to see the issue of tax systems as far greater than their own individual circumstances, right? As a matter of, you know, the health of the country and the economy, then, you know, what's there not to like? So, I mean, let's talk about, I mean, how does one market this to these political parties? I mean.
Well, 30 years I've been going to DC and being patted on the back and told what a great job I've done. And of course, the DC, the fix is in, honestly. And what we have shifted to a lot of our attention is not so much on DC, although we do want to try to be sure that candidates running for office sign pledges to support the fair tax and are asked about the fair tax. But we believe that the solution is probably going to be through the states. Now you're seeing 25, I think 26 at last count, states, including Illinois of all places, have come back with tax reductions. You've got a number of states who are trying to eliminate the state income tax altogether. And it's not because those bureaucrats really necessarily want to help us. It's because they are feeling the pinch with competing with neighboring states which do not have an income tax. And they're losing lots of industry, but more important, a lot of their population is moving to these other states because that's where the jobs are, that's where they can get and keep more money. And so right now there are three states which are well along to doing this. One is Georgia, there's a bill. The establishment tried to short circuit it by doing some quote lowering of rates in a tiny way, but they have a state fair tax bill that's got a lot of support in their legislature. Nebraska, the same thing. Alabama, the same thing. And we believe that as these states start to enact versions of a state fair tax, including the prebate, that there's going to be increasing pressure on their representatives in Congress to do this. Because ultimately, like Reagan said, while they don't want to do this, the thing they want most to do is keep their jobs. And if we can get a growing awareness in the public and them asking their representatives, hey, look, it's working in Alabama, why not federally? What's the representative going to say? Well, okay, fine, it's working. Well, we don't believe in consumption taxes, they hurt the lower income. Well, frankly, from an economist's point of view, all taxes are consumption taxes. Why? Because they take away money that we could use to consume. It's just a question of how it's done. Do you hide it with the present tax system by withholding, by increasing the price of goods, by decreasing wages because you're not competing as well with foreign imports? Or do you put it on the table for everybody can see it? I guarantee you the answer in DC is you hide it. But
you're
not going to have a politician admit that.
Well, you know, my view is that modern tax, or even actually U.S. is not of a modern tax code, nor does Canada. Okay, sort of mid-last century tax codes, right?
Right.
Are probably the best place in the world to hide the purest form of evil there is, you know, in terms of, immoral redistribution of wealth, assets, punishing people, et cetera. But what I find amazing about this is that there's no need for an individual to file a tax return, right? Unless they just, happen to want to request some kind of benefit, be in the form of a rebate or something else, but it's their choice, right? It's their call, if they want to engage with the government or not. And for a lot of them, I think they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that because there would have to be an extraordinary rebate, I think, for them to start knocking on the door of governments. Do you think that's true?
I think a lot of people over time will start doing it, but I think you're correct. There'll be a lot of people, particularly Americans abroad, why should they do it? They make so little purchases that would apply. They could say, well, it's an extra $700 a month in my account. Maybe they would do it for that reason, because we're not spending it. So we're getting the money anyway. But, you've got, again, I think you've highlighted it. It's a situation where this is a choice. You decide how much you're going to spend. And it's only on new goods. So, John, you decide you want to go buy a new Mercedes. Joe says, I'm just going to buy a year old one.
It's the other way around.
In the United States. You're going to pay the tax, and Joe's not. But that's your choice. That's not some bureaucrat in D.C.
Yeah.
You made that choice. You made the choice to buy food at the grocery store and not grow it yourself. You made the choice. Now, obviously, a lot of people can't grow their own food, but you still have a choice. You still can decide. And you don't have to worry about them changing the rules on you in midstream. It's very simple. The rate is apparent to everybody. If somebody tries to change it, all of us see it. It's not hidden in a back room.
I wonder if the problem really isn't that this is just too simple and makes too much sense to be taken seriously by a congressman.
I don't think so. I think the main reason that it's not taken seriously is that it's an embedded system in D.C. All of the conservative and liberal talking heads benefit from the income tax system. They benefit from the bureaucracy. None of them are in agreement with changing something that's been very lucrative for them. And I really don't believe simplicity has anything to do with it.
In other words, to help them hurt the country.
Exactly. They can more easily fleece the country by having this and having all these lobbyists. Many of these members of Congress are looking at lobbying as a retirement plan. Going from making a couple of hundred thousand a year to a couple of million a year as lobbyists. They don't want to kill that. What is the biggest area of lobbying right now? It's the tax system. So they don't want to cure any of that problem. That's a retirement plan. They get lots of money into their coffers from lobbyists who buy the tickets to their dinners because of the tax code. They bring out that we're going to punish this particular sector. What happens? That sector pours money into D.C. What happens to that money?
Do you think it might be fair to say?
Redistributed.
Yeah. Do you think it might be fair to say that one of the principal purposes of the U.S. tax code is to provide lucrative retirement incomes for Congress?
It has become that, not only for Congress, but look at everybody else. John and Joe, when I first started going to D.C., I met with people that were, quote, the talking heads that were both conservative and liberal on that side. And they were talking about the tax code. And many of the ones on the conservative side said, oh, it's a great idea. We need to do this. But they are making their money, just like the Tax Foundation, from commenting on the income tax. You get rid of the income tax, a lot of their reason for making money goes away. What is the Tax Foundation going to do? There's no longer an income tax to lobby.
What will all the tax professors, what will all the tax lawyers do? They're going to be like you, recovering tax attorneys.
That's right. And most of them, quite honestly, that I've worked with are very bright people, and they can move into other areas. But, should we be, we'd be better off taking the people that would be affected and paying them income for life and getting rid of this system.
Yeah.
We'd be way ahead economically.
Well,
and so, you know, but they're going to survive, just like the buggy whip manufacturers, just like the wagon wheel makers. They're going to survive. They're going to morph into businesses. And because of the incredible growth of capital, I mean, you guys are overseas. Tell me what would happen if people that you knew that had money were told that they could bring their money to the U.S. They would never have to pay any tax on that money. They could invest it. They could get a return of 10, 15, 20%, never be taxed. They could pull the money out anytime they wanted, or they could go to Germany. They could make the investment. They could pay up to 30 to 40% in tax on the same investment. What are they going to do?
I think they might possibly find the United States a more attractive destination. I don't know. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah. I think, Steve mentioned the lobbying organizations. I think two of them I might mention are the American Citizens Abroad and the American Association of Citizens Resident Overseas. You would think that they would jump on the fair tax, but like a lot of these other organizations, they make a lot of their money by commenting on the current tax code and trying to get rid of extraterritorial taxation within the framework of what everybody knows. So they're not going to step out of the box to try to advocate, but this is where we need to have a very serious education initiative to let American citizens abroad know that there's another way, that now that they can vote, which I couldn't, by the way, as we know from the last episode when we had this podcast, I too was an American citizen who lived overseas, and I was subject to the full brunt of the IRS and the German Finanzamt. I lived in Germany, and the one thing that I couldn't do that American citizens now is vote. But one thing I didn't have that American citizens now have is FATCA. That's the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, which makes it very difficult for American citizens overseas to open a bank account. And I don't know, Joe, if you've had some personal experience with that, but that's one problem that would go away if we had the fair tax, because as I understand, the FATCA is part of one of the subtitles of the Internal Revenue Code that would go away. So,
well, there'd be no reason for it, because you're moving just to a consumption-based, or put another way, just basically a consumption-based territorial tax system, right, is what you're...
Precisely.
I mean, my God, the Internal Revenue, what did you say, 135 pages? Is that what you peg your fair tax code at?
That's what it is. Double-spaced, wide margins.
Where is it? Where is it? I mean, I think it needs to be distributed.
Sure. Go to congress.gov and look up HR 25, and you'll pull up the fair tax, and the full text of the fair tax is right there in front of you.
All right, let's repeat that again.
HR 25 on congress.gov,
and this would
go look it up.
This would solve the problem of all Americans.
Absolutely.
Well, actually, John, I think that it would solve a lot more than just American problems, because you're going to see, as I said before, what's Germany going to do when there's a huge movement of capital out of Germany?
First thing we'll do is try to prevent it from leaving.
That's right. And that will only help with the money that's from German investors. But if they can't attract money from anybody else, what are they going to have to do? They're going to, first of all, yell and scream. But then they're going to have to modify their tax system to be competitive. It's all going to be a question of being competitive. And I think this is something that once this change took effect with the world's biggest economy, you're going to see movement to this system, not because the bureaucracies and the governments want to, but in order to actually compete. Because as long as capital can move, and right now there's between $15 and $30 trillion, depending on who you ask, on the shelf, meaning offshore from every jurisdiction. people who have secreted money over there, you know, African dictators, you know, all these different things. A lot of Russians, a lot of Chinese, and that money goes to the most lucrative investment locale. And it's going to go to the country that is, well, safest, least tax, and one of the largest economies in the world. And the only way to compete with that is going to be to help replicate it in your country. So I think it's a tide wave that once it starts, it's like the tsunami starts building. It's going to change the way the people of the world get taxed.
You know, I think that's absolutely right. And as I listen to you explain that, I can't remember what famous person in American history said this, and you may recognize it, but, you know, basically it's, when people fear the government, we have tyranny. When government fears the people, we have liberty. And what you're really doing on a broader, more political sense is encouraging the spreading of liberty.
Yes.
Freedom throughout the world through the fair tax. I mean, let's stop this nonsense about, you know, the United States wanting to somehow spread liberal democracies around the world. I mean, you know, we have liberal democracies with these obscene tax systems. Why not spread the fair tax around the world, and then the freedom and democracy will take care of itself, won't it?
It'll be a huge step.
Yeah. That reminds me, about 8 or 9 years ago, I was in Santiago, Chile, and the coordinator of tax policy met with me, and I was talking with him about the fair tax. He was interested in what he heard. At that point, the president was a free market type, and the first question I answered was, why was I, as a private American citizen, interested in talking to the Chilean government about the fair tax? And I said that, well, if Chile should adopt the fair tax and have success with it, that would put pressure on my government to adopt something similar. So that ties right into what Steve was saying, that if we get the fair tax in one country, as if we get it in one state, it's going to spread.
So really, you know, to promote the fair tax really is probably the single best investment that one could make in freedom throughout the world that there is, I think, isn't it? I mean, just given the reality, there's going to be taxes. So you might as well have ones that promote freedom rather than what is clearly becoming, you know, I think, tax tyranny throughout the world.
Right.
In the United States, in Canada, in Germany.
Well, it's also, I think, important too, because, and Joe and John, you may have seen this, but one of the things about the tax law that's really important to me is that you want it to be clear, concise. You don't want it to be ambiguous, number one, any law. Okay. But the other part of this is that what you want is a law that everybody can understand and follow, and that is very difficult to evade. Because in order to evade this law, you cannot use the normal purchasing channels that we've all become used to. We can't go to Starbucks and get a coffee or Tim Horton or whatever. We have to find another way to do it. We can't go to the department store and buy clothes or buy from Amazon. You have to find another way to do it. And it's just hugely difficult, let's say, to evade this. Will there be evasion? Of course. But will it be the same amount? In California, they had $50 billion of sales tax collected. The evasion rate they calculated was 2.5%. Because almost all of the tax, like 93%, is from 8% of the merchants, the big box stores, car dealers, people like that. So if you have a system where it's that way, you're going to have respect for law come back. Because right now, with evasion in the United States, if it's okay to evade the income tax law, is it okay to evade this other law? It's a slippery slope. Italy perhaps has 40% of its economy underground. They do not pay the income tax. They don't pay the VAT tax. But what do? They buy things in stores. And so what you've got is a way of letting people come back into the market, pay their fair share of taxes. The law is simple. If it's retail, it's taxed. If it's a retail, if you get a haircut, you're going to pay a tax.
Well, you know, I live in Canada, which has mostly a national VAT, harmonized to HST or something. It's 13%, which is low compared to Europe. But, I can see how these things work. And I think that what's most striking about this kind of tax is nobody thinks about it, right? For example, you don't wake up to an article on the front page of the national newspaper talking about, the national sales tax, okay?
Right.
You do, however, wake up to an article talking about, the possibility of imposing, capital gains tax on the sale of a principal residence or something. Right. I mean, just the sheer amount of time, the stupidity of a country, a population, of the world, thinking about taxation. I mean, imagine what these people could do with their lives and what's, the amount of human progress that could be achieved if people didn't sit around all day thinking about taxation.
Yeah, that's how our tax real problems of the world. Sorry, Jim.
The way our tax got started was three gentlemen from Houston were sitting around at lunch, and they sat on the boards of these Fortune 100 companies, and they were talking about how much time they spent at board meetings talking about the tax implications of their business decisions. And they thought collectively, this is ridiculous. If we could spend 100% of our time talking about the business implications of our decisions, we could make goods and services that are more competitive in world markets and responsive to the wants and needs of consumers. So you're absolutely right, John. If people could spend more of their time thinking about the business implications of decisions they make or the economic implications, and next to no time thinking about taxes, we think that the world standard of living would rise dramatically.
And well, that's it would rise dramatically for reasons we're not even talking about. These international tax treaties, which are rooted in circumstances of 100 years ago, were originally designed to keep developing countries poor. And because they haven't changed, nobody thinks about that anymore. But they have the effect of keeping developing countries poor. So, this is a really, really big problem. It has to be. At some point it will change because, as Charles Adams writes or wrote when he was alive, as goes taxation, so go civilizations, both the rise and the fall. And, it's interesting how you look at countries like Estonia, which is a brand new country, and how they're organizing their taxes and stuff. It's completely different from what's going on in North America. The problem with taxation is it seems to lag society by probably 100 years. The estate and gift tax in the U.S. certainly predates the income tax, right? These treaties that govern international tax are from the 1920s. It's unbelievable that this is going on.
Well, the unbelievable part is that the American people have tolerated this abuse for this long.
Why do they tolerate it?
The
home of the brave. Why do they tolerate it?
I think a lot of it's because, Jim and I are both at an age where a lot of our family responsibilities are behind us. We're now supposed to pay for things for our grandkids and kids, but not necessarily raise them. And we've worked a long time and we've gotten to a point where maybe we don't have to be quite as, let's just say, active as my kids do in terms of having to support their family. And a lot of their attention, as you know, when you're raising a family and you're coming along, is we got to get the kids to school, we got to feed them, they get sick, we got to find a way to replace the roof. There's just lots of things that demand our attention. And a lot of it is not going to be necessarily the tax system. That's maybe on the list, but it's down the list. And a lot of people don't have time to focus on things that you and Joe and Jim and I are talking about, the more macro issues that are there that actually translate down to micro, because all of them, my kids, they'd all benefit immensely from the fair tax. But they're living now and they're coping and they're getting along and they've got what they consider bigger responsibilities than being more involved. I mean, they'll put a yard sign up. They'll tell people it's a great idea, but to get active, it's going to be a push. And I think that's a lot of what's going on in DC, is that we do not have enough people pounding on their door. And that's why the state's become a much more interesting idea, John, because if in fact the states take that next step, and I think there's a really good chance next year that one of those three is going to do it, you're going to see a huge increase in pressure on other governments to replicate it, and a lot more information out there, and it's going to become more of a state level issue. And the people live in states, they're going to react.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting point of view.
So, Stephen's right on that, because when I was in a meeting with the United People's Assembly, we were talking about morphing into a national party, but we're also talking about just focusing on a state level, because if you focus on the state level, then it will grow into the national level. Mm-hmm. And I think also using that for the Fair Tax Act would work perfectly.
We totally agree with you.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Very briefly, you know, so many of the things we've talked about, it seems to me, bear on the Biden Green Book that was released, whatever, a couple weeks ago. I mean, just the sheer complexity of all these, you know, proposed tax changes and that, I think, reinforces exactly what you're saying. I mean, it's just the complexity is crazy. And I don't think people recognize the burden of even understanding what you're being asked to do and how to comply with it. It is incredible.
And no, and the fact that they have to hide things on the almost last page, such as the provision that was going to require banks, credit unions, and other financial institutions, and even perhaps credit card companies, to report all their transactions to the Fed, to the IRS, so they would know you got money in, John, from Jim Bennett, and you paid money out to Joe Howard. They would have that level of detail about each and every American. I mean, how absurd is that?
Was that in the Green Book?
I think it was page 97.
Oh my God. I mean, this is the problem, right? I mean, I'm interested in this stuff, but, you know, I didn't, nobody can read the whole thing, right? I mean, you just go to the parts, you know, that you're kind of looking for, but I had no idea that was even in there.
No, they make it so complicated so that you will miss it and not even think about it.
That's right.
Well, and they don't describe what the effect of it is, right? You know, they describe it in sort of some abstract apple.
It's totally was hidden.
I disagree, right?
Yeah, when it became apparent, of course, and see, here's the problem. If you're going to collect this income tax, income payroll tax, because remember, if the person evades the income tax, they're also evading the payroll tax. They're also evading the state income tax. You know, they don't report to Social Security what they don't report to the IRS. They don't report to the state what they don't report to the Fed. So evasion is all up and down. And in order to actually address that, the IRS needs that kind of access, because it's otherwise a voluntary system of reporting a lot of this income and other work. So the guy that works for the fire department, yes, he gets his taxes withheld, but when he goes out on the weekends and works for an AC company installing air conditioners for cash, how is that going to come up? Well, right now he puts it in his bank account. Well, that's going to show up. So if you want to stop evasion, you're going to have to give up all of your rights to financial privacy. And who for a moment believes that they'll still, you know, stay private? Ask Bezos and those other guys who had their tax returns printed. How long is it going to be before that information that John provides, or Jim or Joe or me, gets leaked if somebody doesn't like what we're saying?
You know, as we bring this to an end, I think that we've almost come full circle, because as I listen to you talk about that, I mean, we can talk about taxation, but on a broader level, aren't we back to the question of whether we have a government that has a people?
Right.
Or people that have a government?
Right.
There will always
That's exactly be, right. There will it's, a great, always, it's a great analogy.
There will always be evasion. Well, this has been and continues to be so good. Probably should draw to an end for today, but I'm hoping that I can get everybody back for a continued discussion of this. Are you up for that?
We'd love to.
Thank you.
Yeah. And please have, you know, your listeners should go to fairtax.org and look at it. We're all volunteers. Neither Jim nor I get any pay for this. We're doing it because we feel it needs to be done.
And you are right.
Yeah. And if they would like to help us, they can join with us. They can contribute. They can just get information and tell their friends. But it's something that needs to be, as Jim said, educated through the masses of people, because once they understand it, it's not something that they're not going to like unless they are presently benefiting from the present system. And if they are benefiting because they think, oh, I'm getting a child tax credit, well, that could be done by simply increasing the rebate. That could be done through another piece of legislation and then increasing the rebate. It's nothing that's being done now has to change in terms of the effect of the recipient. It's just, why not do it in a way that protects everybody's freedom and privacy and protects the U.S. against losing everything because of this crazy system to, you know, in fighting imports, and gives us back our country and our decision as to how much tax we pay.
Oh my God, well said. Have you thought of running for public office? I mean, you've definitely got the talking points down, Steve. I mean, that was great stuff. All right, well let's bring this to an end today. Okay, so we have here, this has been a great discussion. We have Joe Howard, who is mostly in Thailand, but today in Ohio, who is a citizen living abroad. And we have Jim Bennett and Steve Hayes, FairTax.org, and the website's fairtax.org, right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the Twitter account is FairTax Official, at FairTax Official, I think, right?
Yes. So, I believe so, Jim.
Yeah. So this is a very, very, very important initiative. And incidentally, for any U.S. citizens living outside the United States, if it isn't apparent to you, this will solve your problem. All right, great. We'll pick it up another time. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye now.
Bye.